A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know those diplomatic readouts where a meeting is described as frank and direct, and you just know something went sideways? Daniel's been thinking about this. He sent in a whole thing about the chair's summary. This ritual where both sides sign off on a document that's relentlessly positive, no matter what actually happened in the room. He wants to know how often the veneer of cooperation actually burns off. Does frank and direct sometimes just mean a cordial exchange of contradictory views, or does it cover up shouting matches and walkouts? And here's the paradox he's really poking at. If these meetings are never truly alone time, if there are always note-takers and aides and interpreters in the room, how do leaders ever feel free to actually be themselves? How can true candor happen when everything is being recorded or witnessed?
So today we're going to pull back the curtain on what actually happens in those rooms, and what the language they use afterward is really telling us. Let's start with the most basic question. What actually is a chair summary, and why is it always so relentlessly upbeat?
Because it's not a transcript. It's not even a journalistic account. It's a jointly negotiated document. Both delegations sit down afterward and go over every single word, and neither side is going to sign off on language that makes them look bad. The positivity is a structural feature. It's not a lie, exactly. It's a record of what both sides are willing to say publicly.
Right. And this is the thing most people miss when they read these summaries in the news. They think they're getting an account of what happened. They're getting a negotiated artifact. I used to think of it like, you know, when two kids get in a fight at school and the principal calls both sets of parents and the official note home says, the students had a disagreement and we've discussed appropriate ways to express feelings.
What actually happened was someone threw a chair.
Someone threw a chair, and the note says a disagreement. The chair summary is that note, written by both sets of parents together, and neither wants to admit their kid started it.
So let's decode the actual vocabulary. Daniel mentioned frank. What's that actually signaling?
Frank means the meeting was hostile, not just tense, acrimonious. If you see a frank exchange of views in a diplomatic readout, what it's telling you is that people raised their voices and said things they wouldn't say in polite company. Robust is one notch down from that. A heated argument, but still within bounds. Full and frank, that's the nuclear option. That means we nearly came to blows.
And useful?
Useful means we got through it without walking out. That's it. The bar for useful is nobody left the room.
Which means when you read that a meeting was useful, you're reading that it didn't collapse. That's the achievement being celebrated.
And then there's constructive. That's actually positive. Constructive means we made some progress, we found common ground on at least one thing. Cordial means everyone was polite and nothing happened. Wide-ranging can go either way. Sometimes it means we covered a lot of ground productively. Sometimes it means we couldn't agree on an agenda, so we just talked about everything and nothing.
So the entire lexicon is a code, and the public reads it as bland boilerplate.
And that's by design. The code is meant to be opaque to the public, but perfectly legible to other diplomats. If the French Foreign Ministry reads that a meeting between the US and China was frank, they know exactly what happened. The public reads frank and thinks, oh, they were honest with each other.
Which is the opposite of what it means.
Well, it means they were honest in the sense that the hostility was genuine, but it doesn't mean honest in the sense of productive truth-telling. It means the gloves came off.
Now that we know the code, let's look at how often the veneer actually cracks, and what happens when it does. How often do these meetings really degrade into shouting matches or walkouts?
The short answer is, shouting matches happen more often than you'd think. Walkouts almost never happen. And there's a structural reason for that. Both sides are deeply invested in maintaining the protocol that allows future talks. A walkout is a diplomatic event of the first order. It's a public declaration that the relationship has broken down. You don't do that lightly.
So what's the actual spectrum? What does a bad meeting look like?
Most meetings that go badly stay within the bounds of controlled tension. raised voices, pointed language, interruptions, maybe a fist on the table, but not walkouts. The classic example is the 1961 Vienna summit between Kennedy and Khrushchev. The official readout described it as Frank, and declassified accounts later revealed that Khrushchev pounded the table and threatened war over Berlin. Kennedy came out of that meeting visibly shaken. He told a journalist afterward that it was the worst experience of his life. But nobody walked out. The meeting concluded. The chair's summary was negotiated and released. The system held.
Frank. He threatened war, and the word they landed on was Frank.
And that's actually a perfect example of how the code works. Frank was chosen precisely because it signals tension while maintaining deniability. If the readout had said hostile, that would have been a diplomatic crisis. Frank tells the people who need to know that things went badly while giving both sides room to keep talking.
What about actual walkouts? You said they're rare.
They're historically significant precisely because they're rare. The 1983 Soviet walkout from the START talks, that was a delegation physically leaving the negotiating room. The Soviets were protesting the deployment of American intermediate-range missiles in Europe. They walked out, and the talks didn't resume for over a year. That's a genuine breakdown.
And more recently,
North Korean diplomats walked out of UN meetings in 2017 during discussions about their missile program. The 1939 Soviet walkout from the League of Nations after being expelled. That's one of the most famous examples because it was essentially the League saying, "You're out," and the Soviets saying, "You can't fire us, we quit." But these are exceptional. In most cases, even when the atmosphere is poisonous, both sides stay in the room because leaving is a statement you can't easily walk back.
And then there's the note taker. You've got someone in the corner writing all of this down. What actually ends up in the record?
This is where it gets interesting. Every meeting has at least one designated note taker, usually from the Foreign Ministry's protocol office. That person produces what's called a MemCon, a Memorandum of Conversation. And here's the thing, even the internal MemCon is often sanitized. The really ugly stuff, the personal insults, the threats, the moments where someone loses their temper, those often don't make it into the official record at all.
So there are two layers of sanitization. The public chair's summary, and then the internal record.
At least two, sometimes three. The MemCon goes into the archives, but the truly explosive moments are often recorded only in private diaries or memoirs published years later. The 1986 Reykjavik summit is the classic example. Reagan and Gorbachev nearly walked out multiple times over the Strategic Defense Initiative. The official MemCon reads as a business-like exchange, but Reagan's diaries, published later, reveal just how close it came to collapse. He wrote that Gorbachev was furious, and that the atmosphere was tense and difficult.
So the public never gets the real story. Not from the chair's summary, not even from the archives. At least not for decades.
And that's not a bug. That's the feature. The whole system is designed to preserve the possibility of future cooperation. If every angry word were recorded and published, no leader could ever walk back a position. The sanitized record gives leaders room to change their minds without being held to a moment of anger.
Which brings us to Daniel's deeper question. If there are always note-takers and aides and interpreters in the room, how do leaders ever feel free to actually be themselves? Doesn't the constant presence of witnesses prevent real candor?
This is the paradox that makes diplomacy fascinating. The presence of witnesses doesn't prevent candor. It transforms it into a strategic tool. Candor in diplomacy isn't about emotional honesty. It's about strategic clarity. A leader can be brutally direct precisely because the record exists and both sides know it. I'm saying this on the record, so there's no misunderstanding.
So the witnesses aren't an obstacle to candor. They're the mechanism that makes a certain kind of candor possible.
Think about it this way. If you're alone with someone and you say something harsh, they can later deny you ever said it. If you say it in front of four note-takers and two interpreters, it's on the record. Both sides know it happened. That creates a binding statement. I meant what I said, and I said it in front of witnesses, so you know I mean it.
Which is a very different thing from the kind of candor you'd have with a friend over a drink.
Completely different. And leaders know the difference. They're not trying to be friends. They're trying to communicate positions with clarity and consequence. The audience in the room is part of the communication.
What about the moments when they do want privacy? Does that ever happen?
There's a practice called the restricted session, sometimes called a one-on-one, even though it's never literally one-on-one. The two leaders stay, and each brings one interpreter. That's it. Everyone else leaves. That's the closest thing to privacy that exists in high-level diplomacy.
And even then, the interpreter is a witness.
The interpreter is a witness, and both sides know it. But the restricted session changes the dynamic. It's where the most candid exchanges happen because the audience is minimized. The 1985 Geneva Summit. Reagan and Gorbachev had a restricted session with only interpreters, and that's where Reagan said his famous line, "If we can't trust each other, we might as well pack up and go home." That was a calculated, candid moment. It wasn't an emotional spill. It was Reagan deciding to strip away the formalities and speak directly, but he did it in a setting where the words would be recorded and remembered.
So even the most intimate diplomatic moment is still a performance.
Everything is a performance, but that doesn't mean it's fake. A wedding vow is a performance. You say it in front of witnesses precisely because the performance makes it real. Same thing in diplomacy. The presence of witnesses makes the words binding.
And leaders also use the audience strategically for domestic consumption.
All the time. A leader being tough in front of their own delegation, that's often about signaling strength back home. The aides in the room are the conduit to the domestic audience. The leader knows that what they say will leak, will be reported back, will shape the narrative. So they perform for multiple audiences simultaneously. The other leader, their own team, the folks back home, and history.
The room is a stage, not a confessional.
And the best diplomats are the ones who know how to use every audience in the room. They'll say something harsh in front of their own delegation to signal resolve, then catch the other leader's eye in a way that says, "You know I don't mean that literally, but I have to say it." The other leader understands because they do the same thing. It's a whole second conversation happening underneath the official one.
When does genuine, unguarded candor actually happen? If ever?
It happens, but it's rare, and it's usually between leaders who have built a long relationship. The Bush-Gorbachev relationship in 1990 and 91 is a good example. By that point, they'd been through enough together that they could joke and vent in front of aides because trust had been established. Bush could say, "Mikhail, this is driving me crazy," and Gorbachev would laugh. But that's a luxury earned over years. It's not a feature of first meetings.
Even then, the record exists.
The record always exists. Even when leaders are being unguarded, they know someone is writing it down. But at that level of trust, the record becomes less of a constraint and more of a, I don't know, a witness to something genuine. We were really like that with each other, and here's the proof.
There's something almost poignant about that. The only way to prove you were candid with someone is to have a note-taker in the room.
The note-taker becomes the keeper of something real, which is why those restricted session notes are often the most classified documents in the archive. They contain the moments that were never meant for the chair's summary.
Meetings rarely fully break down, but that doesn't mean leaders are just sitting there being polite. The question is, with all those people in the room, can they ever really say what they mean?
They can, and they do, but what they mean in diplomacy is different from what it means in ordinary life. A diplomat saying what they mean is saying, "Here's my country's position, here's what we will and won't accept, here's the consequence if you cross this line." That's candor. It's not, "I personally find you difficult," or "Your policies are making me angry." Those things might be true, but they're not what the meeting is for.
The system filters out the personal and preserves the strategic.
That's actually a good thing. If every meeting turned into leaders venting their personal frustrations, nothing would ever get resolved. The formality is a container. It keeps the conversation focused on what can actually be negotiated.
But what about when the personal does break through? When someone does lose their temper, throw a pen, storm out?
Those moments happen more often than the public knows, but they're almost never recorded in official documents. The note-taker doesn't write, "The foreign minister threw a pen across the table." The interpreter might tell someone later. Aides might whisper about it. It becomes part of the oral history of diplomacy, not the written record.
Which brings us to someone who's actually been in the room for one of these. Hilbert.
The pen throwing happened in 97. I was a junior protocol officer for the British Foreign Office assigned to a bilateral trade delegation. The counterpart was, let's say, an Eastern European minister with a long memory for historical grievances. He shouted at our minister for 45 minutes about something that happened in 1944, threatened to walk out twice. At one point, he picked up a pen and threw it across the table. Not at anyone, just across the table, like he was punctuating a point.
You were the one writing the chair's summary.
I drafted it. The official summary said the two sides had a robust and wide-ranging exchange of views. The minister read it, crossed out robust, and wrote in Frank. I asked why. He said, and I remember this exactly. Robust sounds like we were arguing. Frank sounds like we were honest. That's when I understood the whole thing is a code designed to protect everyone's ability to keep talking tomorrow.
Did the pen throwing make it into any document at all?
No. The interpreter told me about it afterward. I asked if I should include it in the internal memo, and he said, this happens more often than you think, but never in front of the note-taker. The minister had asked me to step out for what he called a private word. That's the signal. When a diplomat asks the note-taker to leave, things are about to get ugly.
The note-taker gets excluded from the worst moments deliberately.
It's part of the choreography. The note-taker leaves, the interpreters stay, and whatever happens in those 5 or 10 minutes doesn't exist on paper. Both sides know it. Both sides want it that way. The minister gets to vent, the counterpart gets to vent, and then the note-taker comes back in and everyone pretends it was a constructive discussion.
The interpreters are the only witnesses.
Interpreters see everything. They're the invisible people in the room. They hear the threats, the insults, the moments of actual honesty. And they never write any of it down, at least not officially. I knew an interpreter who kept a private diary for 30 years. When he retired, he burned it, said it wasn't safe for anyone to read.
That diary is the real diplomatic record, and it doesn't exist.
That's the job. You hear everything, and you take it to the grave.
The system works, but it works by keeping the public in the dark about what actually happened. Is that a feature or a bug?
Both. It's a feature if you want diplomacy to function. It's a bug if you want to know what your government is doing in your name. The people who design these systems chose function.
The people who live with the consequences get the chair's summary.
They get frank and constructive, which could mean anything from, we disagreed politely, to, he threw a pen and threatened to walk out. The whole point is, you can't tell which.
Do you think that's sustainable? With live-streamed summits and social media readouts and everything moving toward transparency?
The code adapts. They'll find new words. Or they'll stop putting anything meaningful in the summaries at all and move the real communication to back channels where there's no record. The need for deniability doesn't go away just because the technology changes.
The system works, but it depends on the public not knowing what the code means.
Now our listeners know. The next time you read that a meeting was frank, you know someone probably raised their voice. If it was full and frank, someone might have thrown something.
The misconception people hold is that frank and direct means the meeting was honest and productive. The reality is, it's a code word for a tense or hostile exchange, and that code exists precisely so both sides can keep talking tomorrow.
The deeper misconception is that leaders can't be candid with aides in the room. They can, but it's a strategic candor, not an emotional one. The witnesses don't prevent truth-telling. They make it binding.
Which leaves us with an open question. If the whole system is designed to preserve future cooperation by sanitizing the record, does that mean we, the public, are never really told the truth about high-stakes diplomacy? And if so, is that a necessary fiction or a dangerous opacity?
I think it's both, and the tension between those two things is never going to be resolved. The system works because it's opaque. The opacity is what gives leaders room to maneuver. But it also means we're trusting them to use that room wisely, and we don't always get to check their work.
As diplomacy becomes more public, live stream summits, real-time social media readouts, the old code of euphemisms is under pressure. The question is whether we're moving toward a world where the veneer is thinner and blow-ups happen in real time, or whether the code just goes deeper underground.
My bet is on deeper underground. The back channels get more important, the public summaries get even more empty, and the real conversations happen in settings where there's no record at all. The interpreters will still know. They always know.
This has been My Weird Proms. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us honest and for not throwing any pins.
If you want more on the hidden mechanics of how the world actually works, check out our back catalog at myweirdprompts.com. And if you've got a question about something that happens behind closed doors, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Until then, next time you read that a meeting was frank, you know what that really means.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us.
show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.